Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jacek Miłuński, and during this session, my colleagues, Raf and Andrzej, will show you a couple of malware samples. They will explain how these malware samples work, and they will also demonstrate a couple of countermeasures which can be used to prevent against the malware. Overview of our session, we would like to tell you something about ourselves, why malware reverse engineering is important. We will tell about mitigation techniques, show a couple of demos, and you are free to go and enjoy semifinals, Germany versus Italy. We work for NATO, Computer Incident Response Capability. And our organization is responsible for giving incident response support to NATO. NATO is a North Atlantic Treaty Organization consisting of 28 member nations. And NSERC role within NATO is to provide installation, execution, implementation and development of NATO-wide cyber defense support. Some numbers, we have more than 100 sites, more than 100,000 workstations. In the recent 12 months, we supported 8 major military operations. And as an organization, we provide centralized incident response. We have a couple of enterprise-wide tools like central intrusion prevention system. We have enterprise-wide antivirus solution. And also we provide centralized incident response to all incidents which happen to computers and networks in NATO. How we work? We are divided into 3 sections, and our approach to incident response process is to go through 5 element cycle. The most important element is preventive one, because it's always better to prevent than to remediate after incident. And as you see on the slide, we have a couple of functions, a couple of responsibilities. They fit well into this five elements cycle, and they are distributed among 3 sections. So how reverse engineering service fits into this picture? Reverse engineering malware is just a small part of what we are doing in NSERC. Still, it is very important and fits well into the bigger picture. For instance, if our organization is affected by malware attack, we can analyze malware. We can see what malware sample is supposed to do, and after, based on the results of the analysis, we can fit our firewalls systems, which are centrally managed. We can write signatures for intrusion prevention systems. We can also give some feedback to host intrusion prevention systems. So, in fact, we can block further attacks to other sites. How many of you were affected by malware? Okay. As I have heard, people, we can divide people to those who know that they were affected and those who don't know. So if you were affected, or someone of your family or friends was affected, you may have thought about, okay, how this malware works and what countermeasures can be used to prevent it. So I hope our session will respond to your questions. Raf?
Okay, thanks, Jacek. So if you think about malware blocking and mitigation techniques, we will talk about some advanced mitigation techniques here that are quite interesting. But don't forget, the majority of the malware that exists out there is still blocked by patching, antivirus, running a standard user, and then you can use some additional techniques to block the real advanced stuff. Especially when you talk about the 0 days ones. 0 day, or let's say a malware that exploits 0 days. Well, of course, patching won't help you because 0 days means there's no patch for it. Yeah. Very often, antivirus doesn't know about it, so can't do anything about it. And even running a standard user will not always give you a solution. Why not? Because a lot of where does the data actually live? It's not in the kernel, it's in the user mode. It's the user who accesses the data. And if you can run in user mode, for a lot of malware, it's already good enough. It can access all the data. That's what it's about. Yeah? Getting the data, giving it somewhere to another external party who is interested in that data, and that's it. What a lot of the malware does. Yeah? And be aware that even whatever you do, there's always this small chance that you will still be vulnerable. Yeah. We will not be able to fix everything. If you look at Stuxnet, I don't know, who has been to a Mark Rusinovich session? Okay. almost everybody. You will see some similarities here between his session and ours, although we go more into the reverse engineering part itself. But like I said, Stuxnet, Flame, and so on, they use real 0 days. With Flame, for example, they had a collision attack with the MD5 hash over a certain certificate that then could be used to sign code so it looks legitimate through Windows Update. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that upfront. Yeah? Unless you know that it can be, and then you can start taking measures. But you know the general principle in security is you don't know what you don't know. So in the end, well, not much you can do about it. So what we'll do, we take a deep dive into actual malware code. We'll show you some binary code, assembler code, and so on. We'll step through it to see how exactly does it work, what exactly is it going to do on your system, heap spring, and some other techniques. So it's, I hope it will be somewhat a hardcore session here. And of course, we'll try to see what's going on under the hood, how does this malware work, and also how do some of the countermeasures work. And we'll dive into two of them. That is, one is AppLocker. It's not really advanced, but it gives you some, and it will show you how it can block already quite some of the malware that exists out there, because they all tend to use the same techniques in the end. They're not that innovative to come up with something new every day. They use the same methods and the same techniques and repeat it. So if you know about that, you can block a lot of these things already simply through AppLocker. But also we talk about DAP and heap spray allocation, mandatory ASLR. We'll explain later on, where these are enforced through EMET, which is called the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. Who has used that already? Who have seen, experimented with that? EMET? Not that many. Yeah. We'll not go in detail in EMET, but we go see some overview and we'll show how it works and what it does. Some little warning up front. NATO is attacked quite often, and we get lots of malware samples in there. We test them on well-isolated environments, sandboxes, so we exactly know what these things are doing. If you do this at home or in the office, be very careful, because you will be infected. That's the purpose of the malware, to get you infected. Yeah. So be careful. Yeah, always do everything on completely isolated system. The samples we took here are mostly based on PDF. Why PDF? Not because we have something against Acrobat, but it tend to be the best samples we found that were most visible to explain and most easy to explain and to show you how they actually work. We could have taken other ones. My Office has been attacked a lot in the past. Java is now attacked lately. There's a lot of software that's being attacked. So,
by the way, Adobe has done some good job with the Adobe Reader X. It's much safer now, so if you guys want to upgrade, please do it.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. All right. The first one, we're not showing the malware executing in memory or exploiting the code itself, but we'll show you a typical behavior of malware, what it does. Because most of the actual code doesn't reside all through the it's not going to be installed through the exploit, because what you do is, and let me show you, a user gets an email. email contains a PDF file, in this case, that is weaponized. It contains shellcode in there and exploit in there. Okay. So user double clicks it because it's a PDF file, it's nothing, something malicious. You will see that the Acrobat Reader opens up, and at the same time, it executes internally some code which creates a file, and in this case, in this specific example, we'll see it's called a file winword.js. It's called stored in the user's directory. At the same time, it will also create a legitimate PDF file. I'll show you later on why. Because at that point, Adobe crashes. It goes away. The winword.js file, it's a Windows script file, so it's executed with C script. It creates another file, tempqp.tmp, also stored in the temporary directory of the user's folder. And at the same time, he also opens up Adobe PDF file, which is at that point a complete valid PDF file that the user expected to have and to read. Yeah? So for the user, you will see, and I will demo that, Adobe pops up, goes away, comes back with a valid PDF file, user is happy, oh, I've seen this file already, delete, that's it. But at the same time, he is owned.
But, Raf, maybe you can explain why JavaScript was dropped as well. Yeah. Why not?
That's a good question.
Indeed, and we'll go to that, and let me show you a little bit, and then show you the JavaScript itself, because you see that it goes into this intermediate step, and you can ask yourself, why did he not create immediately the executable file, the TMP file?
A fake TMP file.
Or yeah. At that point, the problem is there's antivirus running on your system, and the antivirus might see that through heuristic scans that Adobe, Acrobat Reader, is creating an executable and then starting it. Which is kind of suspicious, I would assume, as if I was an antivirus writer, I would flag this as something very suspicious. So it doesn't do that. It takes some intermediate step to obfuscate what's happening. So it creates another file, a .js file, which is very often ignored that that happens. Then a script is launched, but it launches a valid C script, so it might also something be valid. And that one is then going to create the actual executable. So let's have a look at it and switch to my other machine. So what do we have here? We'll use March tools, like you've seen them for this sample, because as you've seen, they're very useful for this kind of troubleshooting and investigations. So I will, and also have the Windows Task Manager open here so we can see what's happening in there. So what I do, let me put this, in full screen, not deleted. So here we go in full screen. So I'm going to start process monitoring, and then I double-click the file, which is this one, which is a file that actually was targeted really at NATO. Yeah, this is really a file intended for people working in NATO, sent to just a few people within NATO. So we open it, you will see a lot of things happening because I'm monitoring Acrobat Reader. It's a little bit slow here because process monitoring is logging a lot of stuff here. You will see here it opens the file. It goes away. And if we wait a couple of seconds, so more seconds.
User starts to be suspicious.
Should be suspicious by now.
But
it's running very slow because normally a normal...
Something's going on finally.
Right. So you see, and this is a valid file. You see it's also targeted really at NATO because some political issues and things discussed in there. User says, okay, this is fine. But if we look then, we see here now this interesting new process, tempqp.tmp, which is running, which is, has a nice description of WinInit. So if the user might look at it, he might think, oh, that must be legal, valid. Yeah, it's called WinInit, so why not? Yeah. All right, and now let's have a quick
Sounds
look
good.
On what's happening in here. I add some filters, and my machine is for some reasons very slow.
Might be a virus.
I might be infected. Who knows? First of all, let me kill the.
You should isolate your environment.
Yeah, don't infect mine.
I'll do my best, there, man.
Okay.
Okay. So okay. So if we add the filters that we already prepared, in this case, process create is interesting to look at. Because in this case, you will see that, for example, here you see that it creates or executes the winword.js file through C script. Other one interesting here is, and we try to figure out why actually that was done this way. So it will do a ping, and at the same time, adobe.pdf is launched. Yeah. It might be to cause some kind of delay or to show to any kind of monitoring process like an antivirus that is starting a ping command and not launching Acrobat. I don't know, it's just wild guessing there. And then of course you see here that C script itself starts this tempqp.tmp file. All right, so if we go a little bit further now, so my system is infected and you would, if you start monitoring, you would see that it's trying to communicate out to command and control center to get extra things done on my computer, and then the other side will take over my computer and hopefully manage it properly for me. We never know. Sometimes they do. They even patch your systems to avoid that it gets reinfected again with something else. So sometimes they're nice. Not always, but sometimes. All right. So I'm going to switch now to see how we could protect that using AppLocker. And just let me already apply the snapshot here so I can switch to the other demo. So I'm going to use application control policies to avoid that this tempqp file can run. Now, application control policies, have you heard about that? You know what it is? I know some people who suffer from that sometimes. Okay, application control policies, it controls actually, it can be enabled through group policies in Windows 7 and allows you to control the execution environment. So you can control which applications are allowed to run and by who, and which are not allowed to run. Yeah. You can do that to support multiple scenarios. You can do blacklisting, saying, I don't want these applications to run. And for example, within Microsoft, it is used that way that specific applications like Kazaa and some other ones are explicitly blocked, pure blacklisting. Of course, easy to circumvent if you rename or you change the MD5 hash or something like that. Whitelisting is another way in which you then enumerate all the applications that are allowed on your systems and that you want to run and nothing else. Of course, this is a way, it requires quite some management because you have to list each application individually. You have multiple ways you can do that. You can do it through a pod where it is installed, or you can, for example, take the AuthentiCode signature information from that and use that to, as a way to identify which application it is, or simply the hash itself. You can say, I want only to run code-signed apps, for example, or the preferred method I like to use is location-based. So you're allowed to run everything that's under program files and Windows directory, with the exception of a couple of read-write directories in the Windows folder. That way, a normal user, standard user, is not able to download something and put it in a place where it can execute it. So you're protecting against the user trying to download something, but also protects against a lot of the malware. Yeah. AppLocker rules itself, they can be built from either saying it's a block rule or an allow rule. You can apply to a user or to a group of users, and you can have different rule types. For example, you can have a path, which defines just the path to the executable itself. You can have publisher rules, which identify the AuthentiCode signature and by who it is signed and what the name of the program is and so on. You can tune that yourself, or you can just take an MD5 hash over the executable. And for each rule, you can have a number of exceptions, saying, I want to execute everything in Windows directory except that file over there and maybe another file that is signed by this code. You can make exceptions based on the same rule types that you had before. Okay. too many mice here. So let me show you now how we can block AppLocker, how we can block the malware through AppLocker, not the other way around. That would not be good. So let me try to get here back. Now I'm running as normal user here. Let me make this full screen. It's not so full screen. Let me adapt the screen resolution because otherwise you might not see everything very well. So I'm going to do it this way. All right. So this is better. So you will see now I have AppLocker rule enabled. How you can see that? For example, the user downloads something on his desktop, Notepad in this case, copied from the System32 directory. He tries to open it, and what we'll see is, hey, this application is blocked by group policy. He cannot execute. Yeah. So what will happen now if I try to open the same file again? Well, let's give it a try. Again, I'm going to start the monitoring. You'll see the file, Acrobat opening, closing, the file is showing again.
Yeah, I think so.
You just
disabled the monitoring instead
okay.
of enabling.
Let me show it. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry for that. I should have seen that. I'll just do it again. Here you see now. Yeah. But if you look now here, we don't see this tempqp.tmp file anymore. It wasn't able to start. Yeah. We can look in here that the file was created, for example, but you won't see that it is started, this tempqp.pmp. And if you look into the event log of AppLocker, let me refresh it, you will see two errors in there. You will see the first one. Let me see here. Okay, I blocked it twice. Here we have the Notepad that I tried to start and which was prevent from running. Yeah. So that was not allowed. But then at this point, we see that under this directory, there was the tempqp.tmp file, which was also prevent from running. So AppLocker successfully blocked the execution of the malware itself. Yeah. Be aware, it's not perfect. If this would have been a DLL, which was then executed to run DLL32, wouldn't have been blocked, because I didn't enable to block also DLL execution, because it becomes more complex to manage at that point. Yeah. It could have also injected code in some other process. You don't block that with AppLocker. But there's a lot of malware that wants to make itself persistent on your system, and so it installs itself on the file system and hooks itself into the operating system to get auto-started each time the user logs on. Yeah. And at that point, this kind of malware can very often be blocked this way. We can have a quick look to finish up this part. go to the directory itself where the files are stored. John, in this case, we have to go to app data. Let me see here. And then we go to local temp, which was the directory where we have everything. And you will see here, in this case, wasn't able to delete the winword.js file because that didn't execute. And if you look into that, it's interesting to see how typical obfuscation code looks like. Well, very typical there is they rename all the variable names to something nonsense because it makes it just harder to read. Yeah.
For instance, any idea what this big chunk of code is? Sorry?
Yeah. Scroll up.
Executable.
Yep. Yeah. It's in the ET executable there.
Just to confirm, the beginning starts with 4D5A, which is MZ in ASCII, and MZ is the beginning of executable file.
Yeah.
But it's just by accident that they didn't actually obfuscate this content because it might be well obfuscated and you won't see it, but in this case...
In this case they were pretty lazy because the only thing they do is just read the data stream and then output it to a file and then execute the file. They use a couple of external APIs like you see here, for example, file system scripting object and so on. There's a number of typical Windows Shell commands that they use in there to get the file created.
The strings are cut in the half, as you can see. That's also a method of obfuscation against antivirus, because the antivirus will try to find string.file system, and like this, they just split the string and concatenate it later.
Yep. So and in a different order, so it's just becoming more difficult to find out what is actually going on.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Rafa, could you also show the document, the Adobe?
The document itself is a very standard document, as you can see.
Yeah, what I would like to say that generally we cannot blame users, because normally the if we do some kind of users warners in NATO that please don't open the documents which are sent from unknown senders, etc. In this case, it doesn't work because mail sender was spoofed. The person who got it was some kind of related as we can see, is some kind of government document from the, I know, Minister of Economy and Finance in Cambodia. We cannot just say to the users, don't open it. Otherwise, they wouldn't open any document. So, that's a challenge.
Some might be happy with that, but that's not the purpose of it. All right. So, let me go a little bit further now. So, in the next couple of samples, we'll show you more on how to protect your systems using EMET. Now, for those who haven't used EMET yet, it's a good time to start looking at it now, because version 3 has just been released with a lot of new enterprise management features in there. What it does, we'll not dive into it, but I added a link in there to allow you to look it up later on. It is a tool that will allow, on a per application basis, to enable very advanced protection techniques and mitigation techniques against typical memory attacks and exploits that a lot of malware uses nowadays. It is not completely transparent, so don't apply it to all the files on your system, because probably your system won't boot or won't run that happily anymore. but after all, for a number of high target files like Acrobat, Java, Internet Explorer, or any other browser that you're running, it's definitely a very valid tool to install and test and protect your systems with. So we'll dive into that, how it will protect your systems. But in the end, it's using some underlying protection mechanisms that already exist in the system, like data execution prevention, which is do not allow data to be executed in memory pages that are not marked as executable. There's other ones like mandatory SLR, will be explained more in depth by Andre, and so on. And he also adds a couple of new features like EAF. EAF stands for Export Address Table Address Access Filtering. So it's an abbreviation within abbreviation. But so in this case, it is a new feature that it will add an additional layer of protection into the application itself. I'll show you later on how that works itself. So for this sample, we do not use actual exploit code, but we use proof of concept exploit code, which is actually used in quite some malware nowadays. Yeah? The link where you can find more information about that is shown there. so if you want to look up yourself and have some play, because that's very safe to play along with, because it doesn't exploit really. It just shows you how you can create exploits using this type of code. So there's a test application that comes with it that loads the shellcode itself into memory. It puts it in a page that is marked as executable to avoid that depth protection would block it at that point. Yeah. At that point, it jumps into the shellcode. So if you look at it, you have the shellcode, which is a .bin file. It's loaded by the test application into memory, into the heap, where normally no executable code should exist. It jumps to the shellcode itself. It transfers the instruction pointer to the shellcode to point there. And then the shellcode, you must see that's like some code that is thrown in the middle of nowhere. It doesn't know where it is. You know this kidnapping and where they blindfold you and they drop you somewhere and you have time to find out where you are? Well, the first thing it has to do is to look around. Where am I? Is there something interesting? And for that, what it will do, it will look up in some well-known DLLs, kernel 32 and NTDLL, which contains the most interesting APIs. And it will scan the what's called the export address table. These are all the APIs that that DLL exports for other applications to use. It scans through that and tries to find an interesting API. Like, for example, load library. I want to load another DLL. Or I want to do a grade process. Or you have also the virtual protect, which allows you to change the memory protection setting of a code page in memory, which is interesting because then I can put other code in memory in a heap, for example, that I can then execute. So that protection doesn't block it. Yeah. In this case, it will be very friendly and just show hello world. That's it. Yeah. So let's have a look at that, how it works, and then we'll also show you how EMET, and in this case with what's called EAF protection, will block this. So let me switch back to my demo machine. I'm going to kill this one. We don't need that
Should
one.
Do it.
Sorry. And I'm going to my other workstation. Like this. Okay. So in this case here you see already I've prepared, we have EMET open here. And EMET will allow you to configure specific applications with a number of protection mechanisms, like DAP. C-Hop is Structured Exception Handler Override Protection.
That we won't cover here.
No, we won't cover that one. Null Page Protection, Heap-Free Override Protection, EAF, that's what I will talk about now. Mandatory SLR and Bottom-Up SLR is Smart Typics, Andrea will talk about later. So, just to show you what the code does when I just execute it without any protection enabled, you will see that it loads the binary into the heap. At this point, memory address 24,000 hex or 230,000 hexadecimal. And then it jumps to the code, executes the code, which then tries to find the APIs that it wants to see, and then shows a message box. Very simple. Yeah. But very typical for shellcode to do. In this case, it blocks is normal. So let me now use OriDebug to really get more in depth and to see what happens. To do so, I've modified slightly the binary, the shellcode that was loaded, to start with a breakpoint. So we immediately stop at the point where it is expected to run itself. Yeah. Makes it easier for troubleshooting and to look at it. So our code executes. Okay, I press F9 because this is the initial code where it stopped, F9 again. And now we end up here at our address, and we can see here that it was loaded at 3E00000. That is exactly this space, and here you see our interrupt, which is our hard interrupt where the code stops at that point. So I'm going to change that back to the original code, what it should have been in memory, which was 31. I had to remember that for a while. And then I will set the new origin there, so we execute again from that point. You will see, and I'll try to show you now a little bit on what exactly it does. And I'll put some breakpoints at this point, for example. Okay, and then we'll run through it. And let me see here. For example, what you will see now, it is scanning to all through the export address table. So you will see all the APIs coming up here one by one, all the APIs that are exported. And if there are developers in the room, they might recognize some of these APIs there. Yeah, like Windows, I guess this one is Windows string length or something, and so on. Yeah. Now, we're not directly interested to go through all the APIs, so let's jump a little bit further in the code itself. And at this point, let me go until here, put a breakpoint there, remove this one, and jump to that one. And you will see that at this point he has found load library, because he wants to load another DLL in memory. Okay. Now, interesting to see is, how does he find this load library code? Because it's very difficult for code to do, because the code has to be small, so it had to do a string compare each time. Is this load library? It's very difficult. So the technique they use here is they do an XR. So they take the ASCII value of the name of that API, ASCII value, XOR it with what was already in the registry, and then shift it one bit left.
Or right, I don't know.
Yeah. So you create a new value, which is then some kind of hash of the name of that API that you're looking for. So you can uniquely identify it at a point. So this way, it found load library. And then if you step further through the code, you will see that it put some stuff on the stack pointer. For example, let me see here. You will see, for example, that it tries to use, in this case, user 32. So it wants to load user 32.dll, which contains the message box API. First thing it does, OK, let us execute that. We jump again to the same breakpoint, and now he found message box, the one he needed to have. We step further through it. He puts a couple of things on the stack itself. Hello world. Things. He puts it twice in there, one for the title, one for the message itself, and then a zero, which is for message box. Who knows? MB, OK. Yep. That's it. Jumps to the code. And what we see here now is indeed hello world.
Hello, Raf.
I could have changed it. OK. So now let's do the same thing and have a look what happens if I configure now this application with the protection of EAF. So it will block the export address table filtering. The moment the code starts to look through the export address table, it puts a hard breakpoint on that one, especially for NTDLL and kernel32.dll, because these are two most important ones. And the moment it sees code that is not coming from the normal code pages itself, but from the heap itself, and I can switch back to the presentation there. So if it comes from the heap, then he will block it. If it comes from normal code pages, he will allow it. That's what EMET does at that point. Just monitor, hey, I see code trying to scan the export address table. I don't want this to happen if it comes from the heap, because it should not come from the heap itself. If you have an illegitimate application that does it the same way, well, it will break. Clear. And one of these applications, for example, that will break on that is, for example, Skype, in the current versions at least still. So just to quickly switch back here, so I enabled it. What happens now if I run that code again? You will see no message box, and you will see, oh, I had a problem here, and I stopped at this code here at line 45, 54, sorry. If you look in OLEDBG, it is at some point, but it's not completely documented how it works, but 54 is here, so the code before there is the place where we're scanning and where we hit the breakpoint. Yeah. If you do that, try to do that while running a debugger, it won't work. EF will not work, protection will not work, because it's using also breakpoints at the same way you use breakpoints in the debugger. So you will skip
the debugger
through
will reset that breakpoint and will use it for itself in this case.
So at that point, you will not be able to trace that in detail. No. But you could see it this way. Okay? Got an understanding there already? All right. So I'm going to hand over, I believe, now to Andre, who will talk about other interesting things, like buffer running.
Okay. So let me now speak about another protection that EMET, it doesn't implement it, but it forces it to be implemented because that protection already exists in Windows. And it's a protection against buffer overflow exploits, and it's called data execution prevention. To demonstrate this, we will use a malicious PDF document that contains an older vulnerability that is not used anymore. But it's, as Windows XP is still, there is still many of these systems around there, so this exploit will still work on Windows XP. It will not work on Windows Vista and above because DEP will block it because it's there by default. But I think it's still worth to see it and to understand it, to understand the newest exploits, and also to be prepared to protect Windows XP systems as well. And I will demonstrate it using this PDF, and then I will show you how IMET protects it using DEP and why it protects it. So first, to understand it, let me speak about what technique is being used by the exploit to execute code. Well, to exploit a vulnerability, you need a few things. The finding a vulnerability is not the only thing that that you need, because you have to have the vulnerability, you have to push the code to memory, but then you have to use that vulnerability and point to that code in memory. But the problem is that very often this code is located in a random memory that is allocated at runtime, either on the stack or on the heap, using new or malloc function calls. If there are developers, C and C++ developer out here, they know what I'm speaking about. And whereas for stack-based vulnerabilities, there is a way to recover that address from the stack pointer, stack frame pointer that has been stored on the stack, so it can be read from there. But for example, for the heap-based buffer overflow stress, it's very difficult to do. So a few years ago, a very smart person, a hacker, called Skylined, developed a technique and approached the problem of finding the code in memory from completely the opposite side. So he said, why not to fill the memory with our shellcode, the complete virtual memory of a 32-bit process. Of course, on 64-bit, that won't work because it's huge. And then jump to wherever. We have 99% of chances of jumping to our shellcode because we filled it out all with shellcode. So, and this is basically very simplified explanation of the heap spraying technique. I have a little animation here. What you see here is the simplified concept. Actually, we don't spray the memory with shellcode only. Why? Because we cannot jump in the middle of the shellcode. Because if we jump in the middle of the shellcode, it will won't execute. We have to execute it from the beginning. So what we do? We spray memory, so allocate a large portions of memory in blocks. Each block here, as you can see, contains bytes, 0C, 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 there is many of them, but it's only three for the purpose of the picture, and then is followed by the shellcode at the end. And that 0C, 0C, which is called nop slide, is actually an instruction that has no effect, but will just move the execution forward until it reaches the shellcode. Now, why is it done like this? Because now when we jump to that memory, we have a great chance to actually reach the nop slide, because it contains like 99% of the block, one block, and then slide down to our shellcode. So this picture contains a fragment of a nop slide. Actually, our exploit that I will show will choose the address 0C0C0C0C to jump, and there he will jump in the middle of the knob slide, as I will show. It's actually interesting that the address is also 0C0C0C0C, and when you take this string, it is also an instruction that is executed here. This is done for a reason, but this is not crucial here to
demonstration. This is by coincidence.
Yeah, this has sometimes it is done for a reason, but for certain types of vulnerabilities. But we will not speak. If you guys want to know more, just shoot me an email or speak to me later. I can speak about it. So I will show that the execution will start in the middle of knob slide and then it reaches the shellcode. So yeah, let's start the demo. I think it's here, yeah. So the first thing that I would like to show you is the shellcode in the PDF file. So we choose the targeted PDF file and load it to a tool called PDF Stream Dumper. It's a free tool, a very good tool to analyze PDF files. That PDF file that I loaded is a kind of PDF file that will do similar things Raf showed you already, but it's an older one. So just to show on the purpose of for showing depth protection. So the PDF file is divided into objects and streams. So it has a structure. I will not deep into that structure a lot. And just worth to mention that it also can contain JavaScript. And that's JavaScript in the PDF file that is performing the heat spraying. So the JavaScript code that will be executed by the PDF file, by Adobe Reader, this is perfectly normal, the JavaScript in the PDF file, because sometimes PDF files contain active elements, such as forms, and sometimes so it has to have it to have the capability of executing JavaScript code. But in this case, we will see that here, as you can see on the screen, there is a kind of strange code that will be executed. And if you see closer and if you deobfuscate it here, you will see that it's actually trying to hide strings like this. It splits it and it's trying to hide it in a very simple method. PDF Stream Dumper can deobfuscate it easily. And if you put it all together, it will form a call of a method, print D, new player, media. And that's actually what you see here. Here is where the vulnerability is being triggered. What is interesting, it contains strange comments in an unknown language. I'm sure that if you do more research, you might find out what language that is. It doesn't seem to be English, but that's an aside note. Actually, that file contains more vulnerabilities that are being tried depending on the version of Adobe Reader being used. But what is more interesting for us is the heap spraying, because heap spraying can be used with many type of vulnerabilities and is used. And it's a generic method. So up here, we see actually where the blocks are being allocated. So it will allocate 32,000 blocks with shellcode. And what we will do here, we will modify the code. We will modify the code. PDF Stream Dumper has a really nice capability of modifying the code and executing it later. And let's just see one of these blocks, how it looks like. So I think it's okay like that. I'm taking the first block allocated here and I'm saying run. So that's another nice feature of PDF Stream Dumper. It can show you which vulnerability is being called, not for every vulnerability out there, but for most of it. And now what I did with my code is that I put the hex dump of one of the block into the clipboard, so I can paste it into the notepad and see how it looks like. So as you can see, the block contains is all filled with the knob sled, and then in the beginning that's our shellcode. So I will now move to my virtual machine. And place it maybe full screen. So what you see here is this shellcode that is just being executed. So it's the moment where the vulnerability where the exploit transfers the control to the address that has been chosen, which is 0C0C0C0C, as I said, and it will execute instructions 0C0C0C0C. This instruction actually is a 2-byte instruction, and it's just an OR instruction that ORs. It's an 8-bit OR operation that has no really meaning for us and for the shellcode. So let me take a look around. We are in the middle of the knob sled, and if we scroll down, we can see the shellcode here. So we can single step, of course, and the execution will follow. So we are just seeing as the execution is sliding down the knob sled to reach the shellcode. I will speed up the process by just placing breakpoint here just before. Then continue. Okay, then we reach the execution of the shellcode. Let's see what it does. It jumps. That's a call to pop technique. It has to find out what's the location exactly in the memory. And then, oops, we are stuck in the loop. Anyone knows what it does now? No one? So this shellcode is divided into two parts, a little decryption stub, and then the second stage that is bigger than the decryption stage. And what you see here is just a decryption loop.
So let me jump into here. Yeah. If you were on the Mark Rusinowicz session just before ours, he mentioned UPX, so packers, yeah, that sometimes executables are packed. So this packing is some kind of encryption obfuscation within executable itself. And here, Andrzej would like to show this is, you know, behind this loop, you see some kind of strange commands, even for,
It's basically junk.
Yeah, it's a junk. Say, yeah. So after that, you will see that I'm now answering the question of Andrzej. It will try to obfuscate the code in the memory.
Yes. Yeah. So let's do it. We'll skip the, we'll just place a breakpoint at the end of this loop. And you will see how this code modifies itself, because watch carefully all the content here below. Once I continue, it will change, as you can see. So that's a sort of polymorphic obfuscation to evade antivirus detection and stuff like that. So if we continue like this, single stepping, you will see that it will also resolves API function names. Is something similar to what Raf has already demonstrated. The shellcode is there in memory, it executes, but he doesn't know the process context. He doesn't know the APIs. He knows nothing about the environment where it executes. So he has to figure out each API calls and the DLLs, and that's what actually the EAF helps to block in this case. Yeah.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
I mean, how do you think how new it is?
Sorry, I don't understand how.
Yeah? 20 years, I think, this different was on that experiment 20 years ago.
The decryption loop, you mean, the XOR?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's still effective. It's not actually against the human analyst, because the human analyst. So the question was, sorry, that the gentleman asks why it is still used, that that technique, if it's so easy, and it was used 20 years ago in ZX Spectrum and so on. Well, the answer is that it's simple, but against antiviruses, it just works. The antivirus will just mostly do a signature scanning. So if in the encoded, or yeah, that's a better word, because it's not an encryption. If there's some kind of patterns the antivirus will scan for, these patterns will obviously be obfuscated. You will not find it. It's easy, it's very primitive, yet it works, and it's effective against antivirus products and automated detection tools. Not for a human analyst, though, because we can easily... Does that answer your question? Yeah. Antivirus will not decrypt. Antivirus will not go to so far. So the question, the remark here was that the antivirus will see the code in memory, the decrypted code. Well, not really, because most antiviruses will not do it, because it's in real time when they do the on access scanning. So not the on demand, but you see the scan where the operation is performed by the system, operating system. So in real time, it's too time consuming, and they are not doing it. Yeah. You would be surprised that what most antiviruses does. I had done some research about it in the past, and some of them, let's say half of them just do snapshot of the a checksum. The MD5 checksum on the PDF file, and that's all. So I just, it's really interesting. I just, there was a file, yeah? Yeah, I will explain it, okay? Because I'm talking about many antiviruses. So the question was which antivirus I'm talking about. So I took a PDF file, one like this, and I uploaded it on VirusTotal, and I got like 20 detections. Then I just added one byte at the end of the PDF file. That doesn't change in functionality. It changes nothing, completely nothing. The PDF file will work, will open, and so on. But the MD5 checksum changes. I uploaded it again to VirusTotal, and this eliminated 10 of them. So only 10 more were detecting it. So that tells something about what antiviruses are using for detection. It was really surprising to me, but yes, please.
I was wondering, all the jumps are bump jumps, which makes the code longer, and I think more difficult to write. So is there a reason? Are all the jumps short jumps?
I don't think it's a long jump, no?
Because
yeah, you're right. It's a long jump. Yeah.
I was wondering, is there a reason why they do it?
About which one?
Maybe because we're running short on time.
Yes. Which one? That jump? I think it's a short jump,
lower.
But
lower. Well, it's only the book shows it as call.
Yes.
But they could have just done short jumps.
Yes, but
it's not always clear.
It's 6 bytes instead of.
Yes, you're right. I didn't think why they used something like this.
Maybe there was a good reason for it.
No,
yeah, that. But okay. I don't know. The jumps are short, you're right, but the calls are actually long. So it's a call far, I think, or something like that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me just keep going, because we're running.
We'll have to hold on off on a little bit of questions, because we still have 15 minutes and actually quite a lot of things we want to show you. But maybe we can skip the hip spray protection demo there
to avoid that.
Because that's not.
So yeah, let me. Where are we? Let me demonstrate now how DEP blocks it. So that's this slide. So DEP, in its concept, it's a very simple in principles. It will just mark all the dynamically allocated memory region, so as not executable. So the process is not able to execute the codes that was sprayed in the block, because that memory block will be marked as non-executable hardware-wise. So it will the process will just stop and will be killed, and that's what we are going to show next.
Can we take questions afterwards if possible, because otherwise we're running really over time. Thanks.
Yeah, so let me change here. Okay,
so
yeah, okay. So what I will do, I'm loading now another snapshot in the virtual machine that I have prepared with EMET. And I'll be opening the same file. So first, EMET. Raf already showed you the application configuration of EMET. We enable DEP. Yeah. Kind of slow again. Come on.
Your machine is also infected.
Yeah, you infected me. Yeah. Okay, then this one, okay, should be okay. Now I'm launching Adobe Reader, and I will attach a debugger to it just to see what's going on and be able to see how the process stops, hopefully. So let's continue here. And I'm now opening the same file, looking at the debugger. So yes, you see here in the bottom, the debugger says access violation when executing 0C0C0C0C. So it didn't allow the code to execute. If you continue, so let's imagine the debugger wasn't there, and we continue, we pass the exception to the process. You will see in the bottom here the message from EMET saying proudly that it detected DEP mitigation, and the process will be killed. Yeah. So let me go because we don't have a lot of time now. Yeah, I quickly said that I was supposed to do another demo, but we have, I'm afraid we have no time for that. This particular exploit could have been stopped by another mitigation that is included in EMET, which is heap spray allocation protection. Well, and the way it does it, the logic behind it is that it will the exploit writers, they often choose predictable addresses. I mean, address like 0C0C0C0C is a sort of standard, and it can be also 0A0A0A, but all these popular addresses will be pre-allocated by EMET and will not be available to be sprayed. So it will actually not jump to the heap spray, because that particular virtual address will be not available for the process in the process space. And yeah, this can be easily circumvented, actually, because you can choose another address. You cannot block the whole memory from being allocated. So yeah, but it's true that against most of processes, it actually is very successful. Yeah. Yeah, that will skip. Okay, now I will speak about another protection, which is called ASLR, which stands for Ralph, help me, please.
address space layout,
address space
randomization.
Layout and randomization. And yeah, I'll do a little introduction. So like I said, in Windows Vista, DEP is there by default. So exploit writers had to do something with that because the PDF that I showed you is not going to work there on Vista. So they had to come with another concept of exploits, and this is called the concept behind it is called ROP, which stands for Return Oriented Programming, which is basically using read instructions without the preceding call instructions, which is really clever, quite clever technique of driving the execution, jumping from the DLLs inside the DLL from carefully selected parts of the DLL that are executed, and that parts that will be executed, they form the complete code that will be executed. It's
So you can imagine that in a very simple way to put it, it's puts just a number of return addresses on the stack, which point to very small code pages in existing DLLs that are immediately followed by another return instruction. So it has to find code that it really wants to execute. That's interesting for him. So it has to compose from all the existing code that's already in memory those instructions that are nice for him, through the return instruction, jump to these places in memory, get back on the return, but the return will then just pop up another address from the stack and jump to the other code. And in that way, without going to memory and then allocated or the heap and so on, it then can still execute a number of instructions just by putting the return addresses on the stack itself. To describe it very briefly.
So you see the execution chain here, this return instruction here. It's actually executing in a single instruction and then the following return instruction. The return instruction thinks that it's fetching the return pointer from the stack that was put there by the call instruction, but the call instruction was not called. So in the end, the return instruction will fetch an arbitrary hard-coded address in the exploit that will drive it to some place, to another place in the same DLL or in another DLL, and so on and so on. So the shellcode consists not from instructions, the machine code, the assembly, but from pointers to DLLs, because these can be executed. You cannot block the execution of memory where the DLL is located. So that's how they over circumvent DEP protection. So I think we have a little bit more time to try to do demo.
Yeah, go ahead with the demo. Unless you want to go party already now, but no, let's take the other 10 minutes or so to finish this.
So I will skip the PDF dumper part, and we'll go directly to show the. Okay, so I'm restoring the. I'm restoring another snapshot. That's a Windows Vista, and we will show the same exploit that I was on the slide. I will just step through it to show you how the execution follows. So. This call, a dword pointer EAX, is the moment where the execution splits from the legitimate code in Adobe Reader to a shellcode. Well, it's not in this case a real shellcode, but the fragments of DLL that form the shellcode. So in this case, this call is not supposed to jump to that DLL. It's actually very important that they chose this DLL, the IQ CNV 36, because that particular DLL is not will not be protected, but ASLR. I will speak about it later. Yeah.
It's always located in the same place in memory, so it has predictable return addresses and addresses where it goes.
I will explain how ASLR protects it, but okay. So, if we single step into it. We see that it executes this small chunk of code. That's what it executes now. It's actually something called stack pivot, and it will execute first the first stage of shellcode that is located in the font file. It's quite complicated, but it's not essential. The essential thing is here. That pop here will make the stack pointer here pointing to 0C0C0C0C, which is the heap, which never occurs during normal execution. Stack is something else than the heap. It's, heap is used for malloc, stack is used for local variables. That's for programmers. So, and they're never mixed. Here, the stack pointer points to the heap, and he will execute one by one, single instruction, followed by return instruction without calls. Yeah. That's actually, it's actually not really easy to choose the curve, the fragments of the DLL to actually form the thing you want to do. It's quite a complicated task. There exists some tools that can help you, but it's not easy. And mostly what they will do, if I continue, that's actually here, this jump that I stopped on will actually perform a function call. So all these instructions that were just executed are the convoluted way to prepare arguments on the stack for the create file A function. So it's kind of interesting. But normally, it's very difficult to write this shellcode. And normally, what this shellcode does very often is to just prepare a classic shellcode and call virtual protect x function to unlock, to mark the page as executable. And in this, after, you can already use the... Yeah. Yeah, dep is not working. Yeah. Now, we're almost over here on time. But okay, so... basically, how can we protect against it? Well, all these addresses pointing to the DLL in the shellcode, they are hard-coded. They are hard-coded. So if the DLL was located somewhere else in memory, we could have avoided it. And that's what the address space layout randomization, is it correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Thank you very much. It does. It just forces the system to allocate the executable itself and all the DLLs that the executable loads to a different place in memory each time it's loaded. Like this, the program will not be able to execute it because it will jump into the void. No. Yeah.
Do can you maybe just can show how it acts actually with EMAT enabled? So.
Yeah, don't know if we have time still.
No, just demo it, maybe just a simple way that it actually blocks it. And,
So let's run the same PDF with EMAT enabled. We will see if it works or if it doesn't work. It shouldn't. Yeah.
Because what you will see that happens is that the DLL that it used before to jump to the different pieces of code is now in a complete different memory located. So when it tries to jump to the addresses that it had hard-coded, it will just jump to nothing. And then it will be blocked at that point. And the image should give some feedback there.
Okay, so that's okay. Mandatory ASLR is enabled. Deb is enabled. We run Adobe Reader 9 in this case, so we are moving forward. And then we attach the debugger. Yes, we let the process run. And we open the malicious file. It's the same file Raf was demonstrating against EAF. Not EAF, AppLocker. So it's loading, it's running. Yes, this is in this case it was already stopped, but that's specific to that vulnerability. What I wanted to show here is that even if we continue it, we get an access violation when executing some address for A80CB38. That's the address that was hard-coded. If you check it, that's the address in the DLL that was there if ASLR wasn't enabled. Now, as you can see here, it's void, so it's empty. And if we actually can check the executable modules, where the DLL is located now, we see that it's 05900000, which is completely in somewhere else in virtual memory. So this will not be executed. And again, if we just continue, image should show us that it was, yes. So image has detected, mandatory ASLR, process was stopped, killed, we are protected. Yeah.
Okay. So, thanks,
let's go to the conclusion.
So, quickly, to finish up, because we have still no 0 minutes left now. So, I hope you learned a little bit on how malware works and what it does to your system and how it works internally. I hope we demonstrated that AppLocker is effective against a large number of these types of malware that still use the same method to try to put something in the file system, even in user mode, and try to execute that and each time the user logs on. Okay. And AppLocker will effectively counter this. And on the other side, EMET itself, it is a very interesting tool. It will block everything, because even people have found out ways to get, for example, around some protections, like EAF can be easily circumvented. But a lot of existing malware and existing habits of programmers that write malware code, they don't go away. It will protect against those, at least.
It's actually much more difficult to write exploits now. It's not the same as if it was many years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago. It's really challenging. And to bypass DEP and ISLR, I have an example here. I mentioned an example about object confusion technique, exploitation technique. It actually needs two exploits to be present, one for leaking the position of the DLL in memory and then adjusting the ROP shellcode by that position and then jumping, inducing the ROP. So it's getting really challenging, and it's also rewarding, I think, for the exploit writers. It's harder and harder to find them because it's getting really, really complicated.
Yeah. So by that, definitely have a look at EMET. Definitely worth looking at, because a lot of exploits nowadays can be blocked by EMET. And certainly something, if you're concerned about being attacked, definitely have a look at that. So if you have still further questions, feel free to come over. I think we ran completely out of time. Sorry for that. But I hope it was interesting for you. And please come over, and we'll try to give you some further answers if you have further questions. Thanks a lot.